The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And it's hard to give my next guest one title. Currently, we are in Southbrook, a fantastic winery in Niagara-on-the-Lake. Probably my favorite Chardonnays. This is the place I always tell people to go to. But she has projects in Mendoza, in Kelowna, in Okanagan, in BC, joined by Anne Sperling. Anne, thanks so much for doing the podcast.
Yeah, no, this sounds like fun.
I hope so. That's the idea. This is supposed to be fun. And you know what? We're going to go in a completely different direction. Because before we started, you were asking me about sports. And if I've asked any of the other winemakers, are they into sports? And I answered, no, I hadn't. And I hadn't thought about this, that if you are making wine, it's a very physical job. So probably most winemakers probably have some background in playing sports and probably very comfortable with it. I never even thought about that before.
Yeah, no, I mean, for sure, that was me. I mean, first and foremost, I was a farm girl, and so I had the quintessential pony, but because we also had acreage, we were out yahooing around on our ponies around the vineyard and around the surrounding farms and things like that. So, you know, we learned to fall off and pick ourselves up and, you know, do all kinds of get into all kinds of antics with our ponies. But then that, you know, as I got older, turned into competitive horseback riding.
Yeah.
And then once I was in school, then, you know, we were involved with sports and team sports like basketball, volleyball. I got to, you know, play tennis.
What was your best sport? What was your best sport?
Oh, it's so hard to say, you know, because
you were so good in all of them.
No, well, I just did so many. So I got into, first it was like the team sports, and then it was tennis, and then squash. And I even played handball for a while. And then at university, I was on the rowing team at UBC. So I was a varsity rower. And then, you know, I did a lot of cycling. So it's just kind of one thing led to another. It was more about the, you know, see the challenge of, you know, what else could I do than it was about just excelling in one thing.
All right. I have all these questions, but now we're going to keep going down this rabbit hole for a moment. How competitive, okay, I'll ask in a second, how competitive are you in the world of wine? But you have this competition streak in you. Just you love doing sports, both individual and team. In 1993, the Merlot that you made for Cedar Creek, your 92 Merlot, it won a whole bunch of medals in a variety of different competitions. In, you know, the Okanagan Wine Festival, you were recognized by the International Wine and Spirits Competition in London, in England. How did that feel, like just in terms of the competitive side of you?
Well, I guess it's always great to get that kind of recognition, or, you know, other recognition, even just, you know, when consumers respond and give you their feedback. I also, at one time, I had a CD arrived in my mailbox from Spirit of the West, and it was with a note that said, "Your Pinot Blanc inspires me," and so I thought you wanted to know. So, like, fan mail.
That
was cool. That was a cool thing to get.
I never thought about that, about winemakers getting fan mail. Like, yeah. Why should it just be actors, actresses, and musicians?
Yeah, so you know, that's kind of fun. But,
yeah.
I mean, one of the things about competitions, and if you look at the statistics, and I've done a lot of judging, it's that it's very unlikely that the same wine will win a gold medal in a second or a third competition. And it has a lot to do with what else is in the mix, what the composition of the judging panel is, and, you know, things like that. So after a while, you know, you start to realize that competitions aren't the final word, and, you know, it's more about the longevity of what you're doing, what the quality of the wine is, how it lives, and, you know, ages and those kind of things. So And it's also humbling because, you know, every vintage is a little bit different. And so after a while, you start to realize that it's not all about you as a winemaker. I think that's, you know, something that older winemakers realize. It's not all about you. It's also about the quality of the vineyard, the quality of the planting, the outcome of the season, things like that.
Do you think wineries use competitions or, of course they do. Is it incorrect when, no, even that's not the right question. When wine competitions, as you mentioned, I've heard the studies as well that they are fraught with inconsistency. And hey, it's great to win, but it's not always the end all be all. Yet so many wines, you see them on the label and they'll have little stickers of all the wine competitions that they've won in the past. How much should the wine buyer be a little bit wary of those platitudes?
I think that people should trust their palates more, and we have tasting rooms, you know, throughout the province and in the wine regions where people can go and taste the wines and make their choices. Or, you know, I mean, you can buy a bottle and see if you like it and then go back and get more. I think that's really what I'd love, is for people not to be nervous about their selection or making the wrong choice, but just to feel confident in their palate. But competitions, medals, scores, accolades, all of those things, I think, are mainly for consumers to give them confidence in making a choice. So it's kind of a double-edged sword that way.
What advice would you give to the listeners? Because this is one of the themes of this podcast. It's about making wine fun. It's about making wine approachable and making it less intimidating. What advice would you give to people, whether they're at a restaurant, at the LCBO, at Total Wine, wherever it is they purchase any sort of wine? What advice would you give so they would be less nervous?
Probably I would say, don't be shy to ask questions. If you're in a restaurant, there's a server there, or hopefully a sommelier, that's their job or their purpose is to make the wine list more understandable or more approachable. So don't be shy about asking questions. And, you know, if there's something that you like and you know you like it, then go for it. Whether you think that, oh, this is going to be the perfect match or not, a lot of enjoyment of wine is the atmosphere and your kind of mindset and your frame of mind. Mm-hmm. And so if it's something you like, a food you like and a wine you like, you'll enjoy it.
With Southbrook, one of the calling cards, when people who know anything about wine, when they think of Southbrook, organic, biodynamic, all those practices, you guys are the ones fully certified in all those sort of practices. And people see those terms. They see them, oh, this is a biodynamic or organic. But what specific, because it's a huge part of you, of your past, of making wine, of your philosophy. What does it specifically mean? When someone sees on the bottle organic or biodynamic, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, we could get into a lot of it, a lot of detail. The first thing that it means is that we're bucking a trend. Mm-hmm. We're not conventional, so it means that we're thinking a lot about what we do. We're thinking about where we are on the planet and how we're treating the earth. And so I think just as a cue, hey, these guys are, you know, they're not going with the crowd. But in what it means to consumers is that we're also interested in quality. So there's a lot of evidence through those wine competitions, if you study them, or through history showing about quality wines that age well and that show their place of origin, that organic and biodynamic wines are always in, you know, better than their conventional counterparts. And that's from a sensory standpoint, so an enjoyment standpoint, or, you know, any of the other quality factors that you want to bring into it. As organic wines and BD, these are wines that are made without synthetic pesticides, chemical fertilizers, no herbicides. So what we're leaving on the earth, or what's kind of passing through our soils, is all stuff that will be healthy and keep that land alive for years to come. So whether you're interested in, you know, just the purity of what you're having, no pesticide residues, whether it's about lower sulfites, which we also have in our wines, or whether it's about things like carbon sequestration and reversing some of the effects of greenhouse gases and all of those issues that we're dealing with right now on the planet, organics makes a good choice.
How much easier would your job be? How much easier would your job if you eschewed the practices that you've embraced, you know, in Okanagan, in Mendoza, and certainly here in Southbrook? How much easier would your job be?
I'm not sure. How much easier would it be if what?
As a winemaker, if you didn't have to worry about being fully biodynamic and organic, if you could use all the different tricks and chemicals at your disposal?
I don't even know how to think that way. no, really. Like, I've been working at this for, you know, most of my career, and I don't think it's easier. This past harvest in Niagara, we had a really warm summer, and then when fall came, we had a lot of wet weather and warm wet weather. Because I work with grapes other than those from Southbrook or for Southbrook, we do some custom crush. I got to see conventional grapes and how they responded to that really radical change in the weather.
Yeah.
And they don't hold up as well.
Okay.
Organic grapes are tougher. They have more integrity to the skins, and so when it rains, they don't absorb the moisture. They don't become vulnerable to rot the same way, and so I actually work with healthier grapes than most winemakers.
Okay, that's a great point. I never thought of it like that. I thought more of it just, okay, we need help. Just get this chemical or get this stuff for shortcuts. So then, if the way that you do it makes it so that the grapes can actually handle vintage variation, why do more places not try to fully embrace just the full organic and biodynamic way?
I think that more people aren't doing organics because they haven't been taught. They haven't been trained.
Okay.
It. I'm always encouraging our wine schools to be more entrenched in an organic program. They generally spend a little bit of time on it, but it's until you live it, you don't really know how to do it. And so it's a big leap for a lot of people to make a conversion. Also, if you plant a vineyard organic and biodynamically, it's easier than it is to convert, because the conversion process, the vines become more vulnerable as the soil converts to a more supported by microbes and more natural sources of nutrients. And so there is a period where it's stressful.
Right.
So,
yeah. So it's
so
more,
it's not easy.
Short-term pain for long-term gain.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to talk about Mendoza, the Versado Vineyard, that you and your husband Peter started a while back, and of course your family winery in Okanagan. I love the story of that, Sperling Vineyards, because that seemed like that was always a dream for you and the family to work the land and not just make Lambrusco. Lambrusco. No podcast would be complete without me mispronouncing something. But how would you describe the vineyards here and just where your grapes for Southbrook are sourced here in Niagara?
Okay, so Southbrook Vineyards is in the 4 Mile Creek sub-appellation.
Yep.
We established on this site in 2006 when Bill and Marilyn Riddlemeyer purchased the property. It was planted, or half of the acres, so 75 acres is what we sit on. Half of the acres were planted to Bordeaux red varieties, and then we had the opportunity to choose the varieties on the rest of the property in the sort of 06, 07, and 08 period, while the winery, our beautiful Jack Diamond Purple Wall, was being established on the property.
Mm-hmm.
And so the soil we sit on is alluvial, so really fine particle clay that's very high in minerals. So the mineral nutrition of the vines is well supplied by the natural soils. And then what we've done over the years by growing with biodynamic practices is we've increased the organic matter and kind of the friability of the soil. So it's very much more accessible to the vine roots than when we first established here. Four Mile Creek is the warmest subappellation in Niagara, so it's well suited to Bordeaux varieties and Chardonnay. Being flat, it actually is an asset in the Niagara region because it warms up quickly in the spring and our summer temperatures are hotter. So that's where we get the advantage for growing Cabernet Sauvignon, which is my favorite variety on the site. It also means that in the winter, because of the flatness, it's a bit more vulnerable to frosts in the shoulder seasons or winter cold temperatures. So we work with wind machines to help us keep the winter lows at bay.
See, one thing I wish, and I want to talk to you about Cabernet. You mentioned that Four Mile Creek here is the warmest of all the sub-appellations in Niagara. That one sentence, I wish there'd be a way for the VQA and the wine media and for everyone to push that out there, because immediately for people that know just a little bit about wine, they're like, okay, it's warmer here. Thus, I trust Cabernet blends from this area more than a colder region just because, well, you know, Cabernet needs more heat to properly ripen. So there's a better chance of just quality, varietally correct Cabernet if it's from Four Mile Creek. I wish that one sentence, I wish there was a way for that to get out more.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing about the bench and the lakeshore is that you have the lake is close to the vineyard, so that has a cooling effect in general or a moderating effect in general, and the bench is north-facing, so it's always getting indirect sunlight, so it's always a bit cooler, so really great for Pinot, Riesling, and Chardonnay as well.
Yeah. Let's go over to, first off, how much sleep do you get? You, just for people listening, I've sort of mentioned it, but you've got Anne here who is the winemaker for Southbrook. And then in her spare time, her and her husband in, is it Cobos Road?
Yep.
Cobos Road, which is a very well-known area for making great Malbec in Mendoza. So there you have that. And because, hey, why sleep? You are part with some of the other members of your family with Sperling Vineyards in the Okanagan Valley. How much free time do you have? Have you ever watched Game of Thrones? Like, when was the last time you went to the movies? Like, I feel like just you can't have much free time.
Well, you could say that I'm kind of boring because all I do is wine related. So if I'm not in a winery, I'm tasting wine or I'm at a wine tasting or I'm doing a winemaker's dinner or something like that.
Yep.
But then a lot of people would envy that situation.
Of course. All right. I want to go through this here. And then I swear we're going to get back to the wine, but the podcast also has the word and stuff. Have you ever seen an episode of Game of Thrones?
No, I would have no idea.
When was the last time you went to the movies?
I can't remember.
What is the last TV? Is there any TV shows that you watch?
No TV.
Okay.
No, TV is not something that's been a priority in my life.
Nor should it be, but just wondering, like, oh yeah, you know, me and Peter, we crush Orange is the New Black. We just went through the second season. Okay, I just wanted to go through that.
But you didn't ask me about what books I've read.
I assumed you read just because it takes a level of intelligence. Okay, I assumed you read. What is the last book you read?
Bursting Bubbles. Okay. It's about champagne and grower champagne.
Of course. Of course. Absolutely. Have you read The Billionaire's Vinegar?
Actually, no, I haven't read that
one.
I know it's sitting there on the
It's
on
great.
The
it's
pile,
a quick read. It's a quick read.
Yeah.
When was the last time you picked up like a Jancis Robinson, you know, Julia Harding Atlas?
Well, I use that more as a reference.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just when I want to look stuff up.
All right. So if we open it up to Mendoza, and we went to the Verzado Vineyard. I'm curious first, what was your motivation to start making Malbec in South America?
So a lot had to do with timing. Argentina had a currency crash in 2000. Their economy was recovering. They were allowing foreign investment in their vineyards and kind of encouraging it at that point. So that's one piece of it. The other piece of it is that when Peter and I are looking at interesting wines to buy in cellar, it's generally wines that are from regions that are currently undervalued, but perhaps they have a great history, or, you know, they're just not in fashion at the moment.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the 70s, it was German Riesling and, you know, things like that, right? So, so at that point in time, Argentina had a long history of great vineyards, of really good plantings, really well-managed vineyards, and a lot of really great wine that nobody else in the world really knew about. Mm-hmm. And so the price points and that sort of thing for the wines were probably on the low side. And so it was, and also we kind of had some time and, you know, thought it would be cool to go and do some research there. It's a beautiful country, beautiful wine region. The food culture is amazing and very relatable to our culture. So we ended up totally geeking out, looking at about 230 vineyards or vineyard properties.
And I wanted to ask you about that. What, for you and your husband, what were your major, like, boxes to check? Like, you wouldn't know this, but there's all these goofy reality TV shows where it's people house hunting. And it's, well, you know, we need to have a large backyard, and I need a patio, and I need my den. And so there's all these, you know, it's like, I'm not going to buy this property unless it has X, Y, and Z. What for you, what were the major boxes you had to check when you were looking at these hundreds of vineyards to find the right spot for you guys to, you know, lay your roots?
Well, so initially the list was longer and then it got shorter. So the initial list was old vines, possibly a house, and primarily Malbec, but could have other varieties. And then it also meant, it also included either an additional property that could be planted using the old vines as plant material, or the potential to convert some lands or to replant and do more kind of Malbec plantations of high quality. So, but partly because it took us so long to kind of sift through all of the various properties, then by the time we were, you know, kind of in a situation or a position to buy, a lot of the great or the high potential properties, and of course we wanted it to be undervalued, those were either unattainable at that point because prices had moved up, or they had already been sold. So the other thing was high elevation. So we were looking at higher elevation than kind of typical plantings. So, but in the end, it was more about the learning curve and the pursuit than it was really about that we wanted to be vineyard owners in Argentina.
Yeah.
So we fulfilled our interest by buying a 3-hectare property, which is minuscule in Argentina.
Tiny.
It was off everybody's radar, but it had an amazing history. So, so it was, you know, by the time it kind of came into our, became apparent that it was available, it was kind of like, well, we can't let this one go. We have to have this one. So
if you explain to the listeners, I mean, some of the people that, you know, the real hardcore wine people, they probably already know this, but a lot don't. Why is the high altitude? Why is that so attractive?
Well, a lot of regions, and especially regions that have had a history of bulk wine production. So So just looking at Argentina a little bit more closely, in the 1920s, Argentina and especially Buenos Aires, you know, got the reputation of the Paris of the South, and it was the fifth most important economy from 1900s to about 1930 in the world. So there was lots of money, there was lots of well-to-do people that were wanted luxuries. So the vineyards that were planted during that period were to make fine wine. So whatever the clonal selections were, whatever the grape varieties, all of that, it was to make high-quality wine. But then there was the depression that affected the whole world, and then that followed by some military dictatorships in terms of government. It turned to more populism, And then also because of the dictators, there was sanctions against Argentina, so they weren't trading with the rest of the world. So wine production became for the masses and for internal consumption, so it was meant to be cheap and abundant and all of that. So anything that was planted kind of in the 1950s and 60s and 70s was for high production. And then it wasn't until the 80s when the French and like Michel Roland, Paul Hobbs, those guys, Weinert, and then followed by Catena, that got interested in high quality wine and selling the wines internationally again because the world market had opened up. So when it came to selecting a vineyard, our vineyard was planted in 1920. It's a certified planting. It's own rooted Massal selection of Malbec, and so it's really great quality wine that comes from it. And so we were just, you know, so looking at altitude and why you'd go to higher altitude. So in the period of mass production, you go to lower altitude, warmer areas, easy to farm, generally flatter, you know, those kind of things. Whereas when you're
often less interesting wines.
Well, yeah, the idea was for volume and alcohol,
yeah.
Right? So you go to the warm sites. Whereas when you're looking for higher quality, more finesse, then you're looking at elevation where maybe the parcels are smaller, the farming is a bit tougher, you know, those kind of things, and productivity would be lower.
What's the one biggest challenge, would you say, if I said, okay, you do this. This is a perfect question for you. Making wine or growing grapes in Niagara and Four Mile Creek versus Mendoza versus Okanagan. Those are three, I mean, at least geographically, they ain't close. What is, like, if you were going to sum up just, you know, both the biggest challenge and the greatest strength of these three specific areas?
Oh, wow. Okay.
I feel like that's an essay question. You don't have to answer all specifically. I'm really asking because they're so different, you know, so they must present their own challenges and advantages.
So I'll start with Mendoza. And
yeah.
What I love about it there is it's a real wine region with a lot of history. So there's a lot of just really high quality, very knowledgeable people around. And the quality of the planting and the quality of wine that we can make there consistently is extremely high. Old vines, all those kind of things. The Okanagan, it's home, so you know there's a special affinity for that. I know the soils not so much intellectually, but because I walked through them in my bare feet when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And so making wine from home is just kind of an extension of who I am. Niagara, with the site that we have here at Southbrook, it's when we selected it, we talked about, you know, a racehorse versus a workhorse. So it's all about that finesse and that precision and just the doing something that really, you know, no one else or very few people are even attempting to do. And that's what I love about Southbrook.
I read this quote from an interview you did with Liz Palmer. What really needs to be addressed is that we receive little or no financial support federally or provincially for organic and biodynamic farming. Now, listen, Doug's in charge, and of course, he loves anything involving the environment. I'm sure the Ford government will be giving you lots of money. Just in case not. I'm curious, what would you, and this is not about government giving you a handout, and this is not just about you guys, but just about the wine industry as a whole. I mean, I already yelled and screamed once that the government should be telling people about, you know, informing people a couple points about every sub-appellation Niagara. I think that would help sell the wine. But what would you want from the government in terms of support for you guys, Southbrook, the Ontario wine industry?
Well, I think from the organic perspective, it would be helpful if we had more acres that were grown organically. Mm-hmm. So it just means that there would be more critical mass and more kind of reserve of acreage to draw from as we grow. And so it, like most countries in the world, in fact, whether they're, you know, Western countries or Eastern countries, if you're converting to organic, you get assistance during that period of conversion, and you also get assistance with your certification. So not just the cost of it, but whether you need, you know, kind of counseling or help to
right.
to get through the process to make it more successful. I think that, you know, Canada could really use a program like that to encourage people with interest to, you know, take that leap.
I want to bounce back and forth between serious and less serious questions. And I was thinking about this during the interview. Your husband, Peter, obviously been involved with wine for a great deal of his life. Do you guys ever have little competitions? Do you ever blind each other? What sort of rivalry is there among the two of you in the wine world?
Yeah, I don't know about rivalry so much. I think we've come, like, we have a lot of respect for each other, and we don't do exactly the same thing. I mean, we've both been making wine and working in wineries and working, you know, with the industry since the mid-80s. So we've seen a lot of the history and all of that. But every day we do blind tastings. So
yeah.
At the dinner table. So there's always, you know, there's that.
Does
part
anyone
of
keep
it,
score? Just... Anyone keep score? Like, Peter, it looks like I'm up on you for the month.
No, we don't.
My sports
score.
Background, I have to ask. Are you guys taste? Are they similar? Are you guys the same? Is and one of you hates oaky shard, the other loves it, and, you know, one wants more bold wines. Like, are your tastes similar, or are there things where you guys are diametrically apart?
So a lot of times we would score wine similarly. I know that he comes, his palate is different than mine. We have like very kind of, we come from a different place, I'll say, when it comes to tasting, but often we end up with the same scores because I think we have a history of knowing what quality wine is together. But for sure we don't enjoy the same wines when we're drinking wine. So I think he probably likes his wines a bit older and a bit brettier than I do.
Mm-hmm.
And he likes his Gewürztraminer a bit riper and a bit oilier than I do. You know, a few things like that.
Yeah. Sperling Vineyards. I was wondering if just, you know, 08, I believe, is when you partnered up with your sister and some other spouses, other members of your family to launch Sperling Vineyards. If you were going to tell people about this vineyard first, how important is it for you and just your own shared history with your family?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, it's, you know, it's the place that we grew up and, you know, spent a lot of years. But we also spent a lot of time away from it. So what's great about working with my sister and my brother-in-law and my niece and her husband is that it kind of brings us all together again on a place that we love. So for sure, there's that emotional side to it and that connectedness. But at the same time, you know, the vineyard was for so many years, like it was planted in the 20s, and it wasn't until 2008 that a single vineyard wine was made from the property. So, you know, as a challenge and as a kind of a test of our collective abilities, it was really, you know, an important step for us to be able to make our own wine.
And what do you guys specialize in? Like, what's the calling card for Sperling Vineyard?
So we've kept a lot of our old vines. So as a grower, my parents felt that it was a good thing to have diversity. So we actually have quite a few varieties, but they're all like really well-suited, cool climate varieties. Our two biggest plantings are Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris, but we also have a really old planting, a 1978 planting of Riesling that makes absolutely gorgeous wine. So
really?
That's kind of our flagship.
Yeah, so you're in the more northern part, because when I think of an Okanagan, you know, I start to think, you know, more Bordeaux blends and more Syrah, but you guys a little bit farther, a little bit. Where are you located in Okanagan?
So Sperling Vineyards is in Kelowna. We're on the east side of Lake Okanagan, and we're just below the 50th parallel. So if you're in Ontario, you'd be in Timmins.
Oh, God.
So just to give you an idea, because the 49th parallel is the Canada-US border, Osuyas, Oliver, all those hot, deserty places that grow Bordeaux varieties and Syrah and Grenache and things like that. But
yeah.
we're it's it's vertical, it's north, like straight up north. So as you're working your 80 kilometers or so north to Kelowna, it's much cooler.
Yeah, and for people who don't know, and they think about, if they think, oh, BC, you know, how many different climate changes are there? Osoyoos is hot desert. Mm-hmm. You guys are north of Timmins. That's really all you need to know in terms of...
Well, but to put it in wine terms, yeah, our heat units would be comparable to Champagne or the Mosel.
Okay, yeah, perfect way to put it. Actually, I forgot to ask how I want to get to it, because this goes back to organic biodynamic, and for you guys, part of it is just helping the earth. I was ranting about this on an earlier podcast, 5 or 6 podcasts ago. It's not political, and it's good to always be skeptical. It's always good to, you know, to look at all the facts. But for people who wonder if climate change exists or doesn't exist, just look at when people are picking their grapes. To me, it's the easiest one, and there's no political affiliation with it. How different is it now versus, say, that 92 Merlot that you won all those medals for in terms of when you are picking grapes?
I would say in both regions, it's a month difference, 3 weeks for sure. But like in 2000, when I was harvesting grapes at Pinot and Chardonnay at Malabar, we were picking October 20th for those varieties. And routinely, it's September 20th here on the bench in Niagara.
That's huge.
Yeah.
That is such a difference.
Yeah. The only exception is the last 2 years in the Okanagan, because smoke... from fires actually delayed ripening. So it's really bizarre, because you have this, you know, hot situation in the summers that's causing fires, and then the smoke was, you know, causing delays. But, you know, it's all related.
So in 25 years, Sperling Vineyards, you guys are going to be making a killer full-bodied Cabernet Sauvignon, is what you're saying. All right, I'll leave you with this question, and I got more, and somewhere 3-4 months down the road, I'm going to be bugging you again. And by the way, again, I appreciate you taking the time. You have 3 vineyards. I know they all, you know, you harvest at different times for all of them, but still, nonetheless, I really appreciate. What's the difference between a wine grower and a winemaker?
Well, I mean, some of it is just the English language, and that we never translated it very well. I think that if you take the kind of vigneron translation from French, you go to wine grower. So that tells me someone who is growing their own vines and working with the vines in order to make the wine. And if you take just the literal meaning of winemakers, I mean, there are some winemakers that sit in the cellar and wait till the grapes arrive on the doorstep. So that would be an extreme, but that's a totally different thing, where, you know, you kind of deal with what's delivered to you versus having an influence over the quality while it's in the field.
And Sperling, really appreciate. I know that some of your Versado, some of your Reserve Malbec, I looked it up. It's at the LCBO Queen East. I want to grab a bottle, because... me and Malbec, it's not that we haven't gone along. I haven't been exposed to enough of it. And, of course, Sperling Vineyards in Okanagan. And one of my favorites is Southbrook. And this is not me just trying to kiss up, because a week or so ago, Bill's great son, Andrew, who I'm friends with, helped deliver a case of a variety of different Southbrook wines, which I purchased. Because great Bordeaux blends and great Chardonnays. Not that there wasn't good stuff, funky ciders and your orange wines. But for me, the Bordeaux blends and the Chardonnays are my favorite. So, Anne, congratulations on everything. I'll send you a DVD with Game of Thrones. So next time we talk, we can talk about Joffrey and what's going on with Cersei, and we can get caught up.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Okay, cheers.
You've been listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Thanks so much for downloading, for subscribing. Tell your friends, tell your enemies, your coworkers, and everyone in between. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, and Audio Boom, and whatever great podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.